From Intellijix, this is Intellijix World Religions, an educational look at the world's religions. This show neither endorses nor rejects any belief. Today we are stepping into one of the most ancient and consequential religious traditions the human story has ever produced. By the end of this episode, you will understand who the prophet Zarathustra was and why scholars still debate when and where he lived, what Zoroastrians actually believe about God, evil, and the human soul, how this faith shaped the great Persian empires and left its fingerprints on Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, what the community looks like today, and why a religion practiced by fewer people than live in many single cities still commands the serious attention of historians, philosophers, and theologians the world over. This is the story of dust, breath, and fire, the ancient faith of Zoroastrianism. Let us begin at the beginning, or at least as close to it as the evidence allows, and the evidence here is genuinely old and genuinely complicated. We are talking about a tradition that, depending on which scholarly clock you are using, may have originated anywhere from around 1500 BCE to somewhere closer to 600 BCE. That is not a small disagreement. That is a range of nearly 1,000 years, and it matters enormously for how we understand the religion's relationship to other ancient traditions. So let us walk through what scholars do and do not know. The faith centers on a single prophetic figure whose name in the ancient Iranian language, known as Avestan, is Zarathustra. You may know him by the Latinized Greek version of that name, Zoroaster, which is the source of the religion's Western label. The name Zarathustra itself is thought to mean something like he who can manage camels, or possibly whose camels are old and fat, though scholars debate even this translation. What a strange and grounding detail that the founder of one of the world's great religious traditions may have had a name rooted entirely in the practical world of pastoral herding life on the Central Asian steppe. Zarathustra is believed to have been a priest, specifically what the ancient Iranians called an athravan, or zautar, a ritual specialist within a pre-existing religious system that scholars call the ancient Iranian religion, a close cousin of the Vedic religion developing simultaneously in the Indian subcontinent. Both traditions appear to descend from a common ancestral religion that scholars call Proto-Indo-Iranian, and you can hear the family resemblance even in the names of deities. The Vedic god Varuna has a strong structural parallel to the Zoroastrian supreme being Ahura Mazda. The Vedic devas are gods, while in Zoroastrianism, the cognate word devas becomes the term for demonic beings. Zarathustra did not create his faith from nothing. He emerged from a world already populated with gods, rituals, sacrifices, and sacred fires. What he did, if we accept the traditional account, which adherents certainly do, and which many scholars find reasonable, even if they debate the details, was revolutionary. He proclaimed that among all the beings of the cosmos, one stood supreme above all others, Ahura Mazda, whose name means roughly the wise lord or the lord of wisdom. And alongside this proclamation came a radical ethical vision that the universe is the site of a cosmic struggle between truth and lie, between order and chaos, between light and darkness, and that every human being, by virtue of possessing free will and a rational mind, is called to choose a side and act accordingly. Now, the question of when exactly this proclamation was made has occupied scholars for well over a century. The traditional Zoroastrian account, preserved in later Pahlavi texts, places Zarathustra's life approximately 258 years before Alexander the Great's conquest of Persia, which would put his birth around 628 BCE and his death around 551 BCE. Many Western scholars through much of the 20th century accepted a date in this general range, roughly the 7th to 6th centuries BCE, which would make him a near contemporary of the Buddha and Confucius, a coincidence that the philosopher Carl Jaspers famously called the Axial Age, that remarkable window when transformative thinkers seemed to emerge independently across multiple civilizations. However, a significant body of scholarship pushes back hard against this dating. Linguistic analysis of the oldest layer of Zoroastrian scripture, the hymns known as the Gathas, which are widely believed by scholars to be the closest thing we have to Zarathustra's own words, suggests that the language in which they are written is archaic enough to place their compositions somewhere between 1500 and 1000 BCE, perhaps even earlier. This would make Zarathustra's ministry contemporaneous not with the Axial Age, but with the Late Bronze Age, predating the Hebrew prophets by centuries and existing in a world where Greece's classical civilization was still centuries away. The debate is unresolved, and responsible scholarship presents both positions as live options. What almost everyone agrees on is that the Gathas are very, very old, among the oldest religious texts in the world that we believe to preserve an actual historical individual's voice. As for where Zarathustra lived and taught, there is almost as much debate as about when. Various regions have been proposed: the Eastern Iranian Plateau, what is now Afghanistan, or the area around ancient Khorasmia, regions of Central Asia. The landscape evoked in the Gathas is one of open steppes, herding communities, and cattle raids, a world that feels more Central Asian than the urban Persian West. But the religion's later history is thoroughly bound up with Western Iran, with the great Iranian empires, and eventually with the ancient city of Persepolis. The Gathas themselves are extraordinary documents. They are composed in a kind of inspired hymnic, sometimes enigmatic verse, and reading them in translation, even imperfect translation, gives a sense of a mind wrestling with enormous questions. Who created the earth? Who set the sun on its course? Who made the plants grow? In the Gathas, Zarathustra asks these questions directly of Ahura Mazda, and the answers he receives form the theological backbone of the entire tradition. Ahura Mazda is the creator of all good things, the source of the cosmic principle of Asha, truth, order, righteousness, and the supreme being who will ultimately prevail in the struggle against his adversary. That adversary is named Angra Mainyu in the Avestan language, which in later Middle Persian becomes Ahriman. Angra Mainyu means something like the destructive spirit or the hostile spirit, and he is the embodiment of the lie, of chaos, of all that corrupts and destroys the good creation. This brings us to one of the most important and also most frequently misunderstood aspects of Zoroastrian theology, the question of dualism. Is Zoroastrianism a dualistic religion? The answer is nuanced and contested even within the tradition. In one sense, yes. Zoroastrianism presents reality as structured around a fundamental opposition between good and evil, light and dark, truth and lie. The cosmic drama is real, and the evil spirit is a genuine power, not merely an absence of good. In this sense, some theologians describe Zoroastrianism as cosmic dualism. But here is where the nuance is critical. Ahura Mazda and Angra Mainyu are not equal and eternal counterparts. Adherents and many scholars emphasize that Ahura Mazda is supremely powerful and that the final outcome of the cosmic struggle is not in doubt. Evil will be defeated, good will prevail, the universe will be purified and restored to perfection in an event Zoroastrians call the Frashokereti, the making wonderful, the final renovation of creation. In this light, Zoroastrianism might be described as a dualism within an ultimately monotheistic framework, a tradition with one supreme god who will win, even as the battle is genuinely real and genuinely stakes-filled for every human being caught in the middle of it. How that cosmic dualism is precisely understood has been a matter of rich debate within the tradition. One school of thought, which became particularly prominent in certain medieval texts, presented Ahura Mazda and Ahriman as emerging from an even more primal principle sometimes called Zervon, infinite time or infinite space. This variant is known as Zervanism, and it represented a more starkly dualistic theology in which both the good god and the evil spirit were in some sense products of a common origin. Zervanism appears to have been influential at various points in Iranian religious history, particularly during parts of the Sasanian Empire, but Orthodox Zoroastrian theology as understood by most adherents today firmly rejects Zervanite ideas and insists that Ahura Mazda is uncreated, supreme, and without a counterpart of equal standing. So we have a wise, creating god, a destructive spiritual adversary, a cosmic struggle, and human beings in the middle. What does Zoroastrianism say about those human beings? This is where the tradition's ethical framework becomes perhaps its most distinctive and enduring contribution to religious thought. Zoroastrian theology holds that human beings are not passive spectators in the cosmic drama. They are active participants, endowed by Ahura Mazda with both reason and free will, and therefore genuinely capable of choosing between Asha, truth, order, righteousness, and Druj, the lie, chaos, corruption. This is a profoundly serious moral vision. Every thought a person thinks, every word a person speaks, every deed a person performs either contributes to the good creation and pushes back against the forces of darkness, or it advances the cause of the destructive spirit. This understanding gives rise to Zoroastrianism's most famous ethical formulation, the triad of Humata, Hukta, Varshta, good thoughts, good words, good deeds. This is not merely a slogan. For Zoroastrians, it is a complete moral philosophy. The three are meant to be unified, thought, speech, and action, all aligned toward truth and righteousness. Associated with Ahura Mazda in Zoroastrian theology are a group of divine beings known as the Amesha Spentas, the Holy Immortals or Bounteous Immortals. There are six of them, and they can be understood both as abstract divine qualities and as divine beings or aspects of Ahura Mazda. Their names in Avestan are Vohumana, good mind, Ashavahishta, best truth or best righteousness, Kshatravarya, desirable dominion, Spenta Armaiti, holy devotion, Horvatat, wholeness or perfection, and Emeritat, immortality. Together with Ahura Mazda himself, they form a heptad, a group of seven, and they are each associated with an element of the physical world. Ashavahishta, for instance, is associated with fire, Horvatat with water, Emeritat with plants. This is significant because it means that caring for the natural world is, in Zoroastrian theology, a genuinely religious act. You are tending to the physical embodiment of divine qualities. Below the Amesha Spentas is a larger class of divine beings called Yazatas, literally, ones worthy of worship, who include figures like Mithra, the god of covenant and light, Anahita, associated with waters and fertility, and Shrausha, the divine being associated with obedience to the divine word. These Yazatas were part of the pre-Zarathustran religious world, and in a fascinating process that scholars still debate, were largely incorporated into Zoroastrian practice rather than expelled. The Daivas, the demons, were a different story. In the Gathas, Zarathustra explicitly condemns the old Daiva worship, declaring these beings servants of the Druj rather than worthy of veneration. This represented a sharp break with some elements of the prior religious world. Now let us talk about the sacred texts. Zoroastrianism's scriptural collection is known as the Avesta, and it is a complex and layered body of literature that accumulated over many centuries. The oldest and most sacred portion is the Gathas, the 17 hymns attributed to Zarathustra himself. They are written in a form of Avestan so archaic that even specialist scholars find their interpretation challenging, and they remain a subject of ongoing philological debate. What comes through even in translation, though, is their intensely personal character, a voice grappling with divine questions, sometimes receiving answers, sometimes expressing doubt and longing, sometimes celebrating the truth he has been given. Beyond the Gathas, the Yasna is the primary liturgical text of Zoroastrianism, a 72-chapter collection used in the central ritual of the tradition, and the Gathas are embedded within it. The Yashts are a collection of hymns dedicated to individual Yazatas. The Vendidad, sometimes rendered Videvdat, the law given against the demons, is a priestly code dealing extensively with ritual purity. And there are a number of smaller texts and prayer collections, including the five Gathas or prayer formulas that devout Zoroastrians recite daily. Later, in the Sasanian period and after the Islamic conquest of Iran, a substantial body of literature was written in Middle Persian, known as Pahlavi, including theological summaries, ethical treatises, and cosmological texts. And these form an important secondary layer of tradition for understanding how the religion developed. Let us turn now to practice, to the lived texture of what it means to be a Zoroastrian. The most visually striking and theologically loaded element of Zoroastrian practice is undoubtedly the sacred fire. In every Zoroastrian place of worship, known as an Atash Baram, at the highest grade of consecration, or in simpler fire temples, a sacred flame is maintained continuously. Fire is not worshipped as a deity in Zoroastrianism. Adherents are careful and sometimes frustrated to correct this misunderstanding. Rather, fire is understood as the supreme symbol of Ahura Mazda's light and truth, the physical presence of Ashavahishta in the material world, and the focal point for prayer. The fires in the highest grade temples, known as Atash Barams, are consecrated through elaborate rituals and maintained by hereditary priests. Some of the sacred fires in Iran and India are believed to have burned continuously for centuries. The rituals of Zoroastrianism are elaborate and ancient. The central ritual is the Yasna, the priestly ceremony during which the liturgical text of the same name is recited in full. This is a complex, hours-long ceremony performed by trained priests, involving sacred implements including hyoma, a ritual plant and its pressed juice, cognate to the Vedic soma, and a bundle of twigs called barasma or barsam. Laypeople do not typically participate in the yasna directly. It is a priestly ceremony performed on behalf of the community. For laypeople, religious life centers on daily prayers recited at five appointed times corresponding to the five divisions of the Zoroastrian day, the wearing of the sacred cord and shirt, visits to the fire temple for prayer, and participation in the cycle of religious festivals. Those festivals deserve mention because they are among the most ancient and beautiful expressions of the Zoroastrian calendar. The Zoroastrian year is structured around six seasonal festivals called the Gahambars, which celebrate different aspects of creation and were originally tied to the agricultural and pastoral cycles of ancient Iranian life. There is also Nowruz, the new year, celebrated at the spring equinox, which is perhaps Zoroastrianism's most globally recognized cultural contribution. Nowruz predates Islam in Iran and is celebrated today not only by Zoroastrians but by hundreds of millions of Iranians, Kurds, Afghans, Central Asians, and others as a shared cultural heritage. For Zoroastrians, it carries deep religious significance as a celebration of the renewal of creation. Two of the most distinctive and often discussed Zoroastrian practices relate to death and disposal of the dead. Traditional Zoroastrian funerary practice involves what are known as Towers of Silence, circular stone structures known as dakmas, where the bodies of the deceased are exposed to the sky and to birds of prey rather than buried, cremated, or otherwise disposed of. The theological rationale is the imperative of keeping the sacred elements, earth, fire, and water, unpolluted by contact with a corpse, which is considered ritually impure. In practice, this tradition has become increasingly difficult to maintain, particularly in urban settings, and particularly in India, where the vulture population has collapsed dramatically due to the use of veterinary drugs. Many Parsi communities have shifted to other practices, including solar concentrators to accelerate decomposition, or, in some cases, burial or cremation performed with ritual safeguards. This is a genuinely contested issue within the community, and it illustrates well the tension between ancient practice and contemporary circumstance. The other life cycle ritual worth dwelling on is the Navjote, the initiation ceremony in which a young Zoroastrian is formally received into the faith. The initiant is given two sacred items, the sudra, a white inner garment symbolizing righteousness, and the kusti, a woven cord made of wool that is tied around the waist over the sudra in a prescribed manner. The kusti is tied and untied multiple times a day during prayer, and the act of retying it is accompanied by a prayer that reaffirms one's commitment to Ahura Mazda and to the good cause. These two items, the white shirt and the sacred cord, are among the most intimate and constant expressions of Zoroastrian identity, worn throughout life, and in traditional practice, into death. Which brings us to what Zoroastrians believe about what happens after death. The soul, in Zoroastrian thought, does not immediately proceed to final judgment. For three nights after death, the soul lingers near the body while its earthly life is reviewed. On the dawn of the fourth day, it approaches the Chinvat Bridge, the Bridge of the Separator, or the Bridge of Judgment, which stretches across a chasm. The soul encounters its own Dina, variously translated as conscience, religion, or the sum of one's moral character, which manifests as a figure. If the soul has lived righteously, the Dina appears as a beautiful maiden, the bridge is wide and easy, and the soul crosses into the realm of the righteous, known as the House of Song. If the soul has lived wrongly, the Dina appears as a hideous hag, the bridge narrows to a razor's edge, and the soul falls into a place of misery. There is also an intermediate state for those whose good and evil are balanced, a place of mixed experience. These are not permanent destinations. they are states the soul occupies until the great renovation, the Frashokereti. When the universe is purified, the dead are resurrected, a final ordeal of molten metal purges all remaining impurity, and all souls are ultimately brought into the perfected creation. That vision of resurrection, final judgment, cosmic renovation, and the ultimate triumph of good is extraordinarily significant in the history of religions, because many scholars argue that these ideas, whether through direct influence or through the complex cultural exchanges of the ancient Near East, made their way into Jewish apocalyptic thought, Christian eschatology, and Islamic concepts of the afterlife. This claim is deeply contested in its specifics. Scholars differ sharply on the mechanisms and extent of influence, on what can be proven versus inferred, and on the question of independent parallel development. But the structural similarities are striking enough that they continue to generate serious scholarly literature. The timing matters enormously here. If you accept an early date for Zarathustra, the potential for Zoroastrian influence on Israelite religion during the Babylonian exile, when Jews were living under Persian rule and in close contact with Iranian culture, becomes more plausible. If you accept a later date, the picture is more complicated. But the Persian Empire under Cyrus the Great, Darius, and Xerxes, rulers who were themselves either Zoroastrian or deeply influenced by Zoroastrian culture, was the political world in which much of the Hebrew Bible achieved its final form. That is not nothing. The specific elements that scholars have identified as potentially showing Zoroastrian influence on the Abrahamic traditions include the emergence of a fully developed figure of Satan as a cosmic adversary of God in later Jewish literature, a development that some scholars see as shaped by contact with the Zoroastrian concept of Angra Mainyu, the concept of bodily resurrection, which becomes increasingly prominent in Jewish texts written during and after the Persian period, the idea of a linear history moving toward a final renovation or transformation, what scholars call eschatology, as opposed to cyclical cosmologies, and the notion of a cosmic struggle between good and evil angels, which becomes prominent in Jewish apocalyptic literature and in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Again, these connections are suggested, not proven, and scholars debate each of them vigorously. They are presented here as scholarly hypotheses worthy of consideration, not as established facts. Now let us look at Zoroastrianism's relationship to the great Persian empires, because this is where the faith moved from prophetic vision to political reality. The Achaemenid Empire, founded by Cyrus the Great in the 6th century BCE and reaching its height under Darius and Xerxes, was the first world empire in human history in terms of its geographic scope and administrative sophistication. Cyrus himself has a fascinating reputation in religious history. He is the only non-Israelite figure in the Hebrew Bible to be called a Messiah, an anointed one, because of his famous decree allowing the Jewish exiles in Babylon to return to their homeland and rebuild the temple. His successors, Darius and Xerxes, left behind inscriptions that invoke Ahura Mazda explicitly and in terms that are recognizably Zoroastrian. Whether all the Achaemenid kings were strict Zoroastrians, or whether they patronized a broader Iranian religious tradition that included Zoroastrian elements, is a question scholars continue to debate. But Zoroastrian or Zoroastrian-influenced theology was clearly part of the ideological world of the Achaemenid court. After Alexander the Great destroyed the Achaemenid Empire in the late 4th century BCE, Iranian religious culture went through centuries of Hellenistic influence and then revival. It was under the Parthian dynasty, and especially under the Sasanian Empire, which ruled from 224 CE to 651 CE, that Zoroastrianism was most thoroughly institutionalized as a state religion. The Sasanian period saw the canonization of the Avesta in its received form, the development of an orthodox priestly hierarchy, and the crystallization of Zoroastrian theology in the Pahlavi literature that scholars rely on for so much of our understanding of the tradition. It was also a period of contact and sometimes conflict with Christianity, a reminder that the boundaries between traditions are never as clean as later history suggests. Then came the Islamic conquest of the 630s and 640s CE. For Zoroastrians, this was a catastrophe of the first order. The Sasanian Empire fell with shocking speed, and over the following centuries, Iran transitioned from a majority Zoroastrian country to a majority Muslim one. The pressures on Zoroastrian communities were real, social, economic, and at times physical. Many Zoroastrians, particularly in rural areas, gradually converted to Islam. Others maintained their faith under often difficult conditions, and their descendants are the Iranian Zoroastrians, known as Irani Zoroastrians, who persist today, concentrated particularly in the cities of Yazd and Kerman, which became refuges for the faithful during the Islamic centuries. A crucial chapter in the story is the migration of a significant group of Zoroastrians to the Indian subcontinent, probably beginning around the 9th or 10th century CE, though the exact timing is debated. These migrants sought refuge from religious pressure in Iran, and according to a beloved traditional account, landed on the coast of what is now Gujarat in northwestern India. The local ruler, a king named Jadav Rana, was initially hesitant to receive them, sending them a vessel filled to the brim with milk, a signal that his land was already full. The Zoroastrian leader is said to have responded by adding sugar to the milk and returning it without spilling a drop, a message that they would enrich the land rather than displace anyone. Whether this story is historical or legendary, it captures the spirit of the Parsi community's self-understanding. They came as guests, integrated respectfully into Indian life while preserving their faith, and contributed disproportionately to the cultural, intellectual, and economic life of the subcontinent. The word Parsi simply means Persian, a marker of their Iranian heritage. The Parsi community in India, concentrated heavily in Mumbai and to a lesser extent in other cities, has produced a remarkable list of figures in modern Indian history. Industrialists like the Tata family, whose corporate empire is one of the largest in the world, conductors like Zubin Mehta, and figures of political and cultural significance throughout the colonial and post-independence periods. For most of the 19th and 20th centuries, the Parsis were one of the most educated and economically successful communities in South Asia by virtually any measure. Now, let us look honestly at the internal diversity within Zoroastrianism, because it is genuine and significant. Beyond the broad division between Iranian Zoroastrians and Parsis, there are substantive theological and practical differences. One of the most heated contemporary debates concerns conversion and intermarriage. Traditional Parsi practice holds that Zoroastrianism is an ethno-religious community. One must be born of a Zoroastrian father, and in some interpretations both parents, to be a Zoroastrian. Conversion is not accepted, and children of Parsi women who marry outside the faith may not be admitted to Navjot. This is a strict interpretation, and it is not universally shared. Some progressive voices within the community argue that this position is unsustainable given demographic realities. The Parsi population has been declining steadily, and if the faith cannot grow through conversion, its future is genuinely precarious. Iranian Zoroastrians have generally been more open to accepting converts, and some diaspora communities in North America and Europe have moved in more inclusive directions. This is a live and sometimes painful debate within the community. The question of Zoroastrian identity in diaspora is equally complex. Large Zoroastrian communities exist today in Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia, populated largely by emigrants from both Iran and India. The religious practices, the language of prayer, and even the theological emphases of these communities can vary. Some seek to adapt ritual practice to diaspora conditions. Others are deeply committed to maintaining traditional forms. Young Zoroastrians in diaspora navigate questions of identity that their grandparents simply did not face in the same way. The demographic situation is sobering. Global population estimates for Zoroastrians range from roughly 100,000 to perhaps 200,000 people, a small fraction of the world's religious population. The Parsi community in India is estimated at somewhere between 50,000 and 70,000, and declining at a rate that has prompted serious communal concern. Birth rates are low, interfaith marriage is common, and the strict no-conversion policy of many Orthodox institutions means that the community cannot replenish itself from outside. Scholars of religion and members of the community alike have described the situation as a demographic crisis. Whether the community's response will be to adapt traditional rules of membership, to find new ways of sustaining community life within existing frameworks, or some combination of both, remains deeply uncertain. What is certain is that Zoroastrian cultural and religious expression remains vital and cherished by those who practice it. The festivals remain celebrated with genuine joy. The fire temples continue to be maintained. Young Zoroastrians in diaspora communities run camps, podcasts, and cultural organizations with unmistakable energy. The sacred fires burn. Now let us spend a moment on how scholars study Zoroastrianism, because the methods are fascinating and the challenges are real. The primary challenge is the state of the textual record. The Avesta as we have it today is believed to be a fraction of what once existed. Ancient sources refer to a much larger Avesta that was largely lost, first during Alexander's conquest and later during the Islamic period. What we have is precious but incomplete. The Gathas, as noted, are written in such archaic language that their interpretation remains genuinely contested even among specialists, and there is no simple way to resolve disagreements about meaning when the language itself is so poorly attested. Scholars approach Zoroastrianism through multiple disciplines. Philologists work on the Avestan and Pahlavi texts, tracing linguistic connections to Vedic Sanskrit and reconstructing the Proto-Indo-Iranian background of both traditions. Archaeologists study the material culture of ancient Iran, looking for evidence of fire cult practices, temple structures, and funerary customs. Historians of religion look at the Zoroastrian texts in the context of ancient Near Eastern religious history more broadly, asking about influence and exchange between Zoroastrianism and the other traditions of the region. Anthropologists study Zoroastrian communities as living traditions, attending to how people actually practice the faith as opposed to how texts say it should be practiced, a distinction that is always illuminating and sometimes surprising. One of the most productive and also most contested areas of scholarship is the question of Zoroastrian influence on the Abrahamic traditions, which we touched on earlier. Scholars like Mary Boyce, who devoted her career to Zoroastrian studies and was arguably the most influential Zoroastrian scholar of the 20th century, argued for extensive and early Zoroastrian influence on Judaism and through it on Christianity and Islam. Other scholars have been more cautious, pointing out the difficulty of establishing direct lines of influence as opposed to parallel developments, and noting that many of the supposedly Zoroastrian ideas have analogs in other ancient Near Eastern traditions as well. The debate continues, and it is one of those areas where scholars' conclusions sometimes seem influenced not only by the evidence, but by prior assumptions about the relative originality and independence of the traditions in question. There is also a growing body of scholarship focused on Zoroastrian women, on their roles in religious practice, on how gender has been constructed within the tradition, and on how contemporary Zoroastrian women navigate traditional expectations and modern identities. This work is still developing, but is beginning to provide a more nuanced and complete picture of the tradition than the older literature, which was often focused almost exclusively on priestly and textual concerns. Finally, it is worth noting that Zoroastrianism has had a long and interesting afterlife in Western cultural imagination that is quite separate from its reality as a living tradition. Friedrich Nietzsche chose the figure of Zarathustra as the protagonist of his most famous philosophical work, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. And while Nietzsche's Zarathustra bears little resemblance to the actual prophet, the choice of name was deliberate. Nietzsche saw in the historical Zarathustra the first thinker to frame morality in terms of a cosmic struggle between good and evil, and therefore the first figure who would need to be surpassed by his own philosophy. Richard Strauss set Nietzsche's work to music in a tone poem of the same name, best known to the general public as the opening music of the film 2001: A Space Odyssey. Zarathustra has thus become a figure in Western popular culture, utterly divorced from his religious context. For Zoroastrian communities, this can be a source of both mild amusement and genuine frustration. Their founder has been borrowed, repackaged, and returned as something unrecognizable. But the actual Zarathustra, the figure of the Gathas, speaking in those archaic verses about the wise Lord and the truth and the fate of souls, calling on his listeners to think good thoughts, speak good words, and do good deeds, that figure remains at the center of a living tradition that has endured for 3 millennia, 3,000 years. Across the rise and fall of 4 major empires, across conquest and migration and demographic pressure and modernity, the sacred fires have continued to burn. The cord has continued to be tied and untied in prayer. The bridge of judgment has continued to be contemplated by souls preparing to cross. That is a remarkable thing, and it deserves our careful, respectful attention. What can we say in summary about this tradition, having moved through it from its origins on the ancient Iranian plateau to its present moment in Mumbai and Tehran and Toronto and Los Angeles? Zoroastrianism is a tradition that begins with one person's encounter with the divine, a priest-prophet who heard in the cosmos a story about wisdom and truth and the fight against the lie, and built from that encounter an ethical and theological vision of extraordinary coherence and durability. It gave the world some of the earliest developed thinking about free will, moral responsibility, the afterlife, cosmic history, and the ultimate triumph of good over evil. It shaped the culture of the greatest empires of the ancient world. It left its fingerprints, how indelibly, scholars still debate, on the 3 religious traditions that together claim the faith of more than half the human race. And it persists today as a small but vital community of people who carry an ancient fire forward. The faith's core ethical demand is as simple and as difficult as anything in religious history. Think good thoughts, speak good words, do good deeds, align yourself with truth, oppose the lie. The cosmos depends on your choice. From IntelliJix, this has been IntelliJix World Religions. Thank you for listening.